session number 22673, reel 9.
Tom Wade at reel 9.
And we saw two B-29s fall into the bay, and we saw one or two more flying off towards the east with smoke trailing behind them, which didn't look too hopeful. Right. Now, I think I'm back to this new camp, Nawet's camp, Nawetsu. Yes, it was 5 feet deep in snow in the countryside, and when we got to the town itself, it was 14 feet deep in the main street. So the snow went up to the eaves of the buildings on either side, and people were walking along the top of this. We walked along the top of this snow, looking down into the bedroom windows on either side of the road, where there was just enough space. Air had let down between the snow and the buildings. It was very, very strange. And we thought, my God, what have we let ourselves in for? And this is February. It might have been worse in January or some other time. Anyway, we moved into this place, and it was full of Australians. There were just Australian camp, about 400 Australians? Less, 300 Australians in this camp. And we knew their doctor, because he had been sent as punishment under Watanabe to Tokyo to be disciplined by Watanabe and then sent back. You see, the Japanese had realized that this Watanabe was fairly effective, and they'd sent other prisoners here and there to him for a sort of punishment or disciplining. Anyway, so there we were. We arrived in this camp, which was one old wooden warehouse, whereas the one in Keijo in Korea had been brick. This one was wood, and with some metal cladding, corrugated sheet cladding, and it was a very rickety old building. And when it, more so because the Australians said they had chopped up wood from the stairs, under the stairs, and one or two other places to burn in the first winter when they weren't given enough charcoal or anything to keep them warm. So they'd been burning the building. They were burning the building they'd been living in order to try and keep warm. And they'd had a lot of deaths. They had some 30 to 50 deaths in the first winter, out of one battalion which was there, two battalions which were there. That's all the remnants of two battalions, and there was a lot of deaths, and including their major who was acting as colonel and commanding them. So they were a fairly unhappy lot, and they listened to our news about Tokyo and bombing and stuff, and without as much enthusiasm and joy as we expected to see in their faces, because they were pretty badly beaten up by events. They worked very, very hard in the steel mill, carrying steel, moving steel bars to and from great furnaces, and in the carbide mill, doing the same sort of thing, creating carbides for whatever carbides are used for in industry. And this terrible work, and this huge heat by the ovens, and then cold immediately you got into your place of eating or place of changing clothes and that. So they were not terribly healthy either to look at. They were often pale and grey looking. Partly because of dirt too, I suppose, and it was sad to see them. And we hoped to cheer them up. We thought we must try and cheer them up in what ways we can. And soon after we came, then some Americans arrived. Kobe and Osaka had been bombed, and some of the prison camps there had been burnt out. So prisoners from these burnt out camps would be sent to places like. Now it's where there was space for them. And so in came 300 Americans from these camps. And they had less discipline, and they were than either the Australians or us. The Australians have very good discipline, and us. And It was a corny bunch that we didn't get on too well with most of them. They were harder to deal with. They'd had very poor discipline in their camps, really. And they'd suffered, of course. They'd suffered more illness, more death. They'd seen more death. Their journeys up by ship from the Philippines later than ours had also been very bad. I haven't mentioned, but we knew that the Lisbon, Maru, only a few weeks after our visit to our journey from Malaya to Korea, the Lisbon Maru had been sunk, and about 1,100 British prisoners of war from Hong Kong drowned in it. And so with these other American shiploads coming up, we heard that there had been many deaths and awful things like the Japanese left their own nurses on board the ship and just saved themselves in their boats. And it was the prisoners escaping afterwards who tried to help some of the nurses. Things like that. And men being machine gunned on the decks by a couple of machine gunners left on board to shoot at prisoners trying to escape after the rest of the Japanese have gone in boats. Anyway, these Americans arrived not very well disciplined and things, but there were a couple of nice men amongst them. Some of them were civilian workers who'd been on Wake Island in the middle of the Pacific, where they'd been building the defenses there just before the Japanese attacked. And so they were caught there when the Japanese attacked, and they were treated as prisoners of war right through the war. I don't know what happened after the war. They might have got extra compensation for that. I don't know. But they were actually civilian employees of a civilian firm. And then some prisoners arrived also from the railway, the Thai railway, which the British had been building in Thailand into Burma. And they were very sickly and very thin too, and meager. They'd all had a bit of beriberi, they'd all had a bit of pellagra, they'd all suffered some near starvation, they'd all been overworked, they'd all been beaten up, and they came into the camps. And they had only tropical clothing with them. We had earlier on been given British winter uniforms, serge uniforms, found in Hong Kong. And so we were always in slightly warmer clothes than these newcomers coming up to Japan in the later years. As I say, I came up to Korea in 1942, and then to Tokyo in 1943. These people were arriving in 1944, late 1944, and into 1945. And they had they'd been torpedoed, they'd witnessed torpedoing, they'd seen ships sunk, they'd been in close convoys and so on in order to get Japan. They hadn't had a good time. So the Australians worked on these rough jobs in these two places, and we couldn't do much to help them, but we got jobs. We asked if we could farm some vegetables, and they said, yes, okay, we'll find a farm. Well, they found a farm. They found a farm for us to farm vegetables on in Naotsu, and it was 6 miles from the warehouse. So every day we worked on this farm, we had to walk 6 miles there and 6 miles back and farm in between. And this was terrible in our condition. And people were, flopping around and unable to do it practically. But this was just the officers, and mostly the six of us who came up from Omori, from Tokyo. And we tried to handle this. The Australian officers tended to keep the job of labor officer, as it was called, being in charge of the men going to work and finding the numbers for them and that kind of thing. And the Japanese didn't try and force any other work onto them except any thing they might volunteer for. So we farmed out to this place. We grew quite a lot of vegetables because the only land they could find to give us to farm in Japan, where every scrap of land is used to farm, was some sandy soil near a pine grove, which looked as if it ought to be near to a beach. It was so sandy. And we farmed that. We took out our own manure, human manure, from the camp in a big vat, put on a cart, carefully tied so it wouldn't fall over balance and pour all over us. And we'd tie that in well, and then pull this cart and march 6 miles, pour it on the vegetables out there, farm them as well we could, have a one fairly decent meal out there because we used vegetables there from our own lot and from neighbouring farms. We'd steal a bit from them, cucumbers or whatever looked ripe and you could see, and could carrots and things you could see and pick and put into the food, into the dish, and we'd eat that and farm out there for the day and then walk back. Arrive back quite tired in the evening, and face the usual evening grind with Watanabe running around demanding this and that and demanding more on parade, standard attention, and punishment often. Small punishment by Japanese was standard attention for 1 or 2 hours. And so you'd stand at attention outside a hut or a work squadron for 1, 2, 3, and the worst 4 hours, you know. And it was pretty grim, just standing at attention, waiting, 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 wasting time when you had things to do, things you wanted to look after, to repair, or to the food you needed to do something about, something else. Awful. So that was often our punishment. And sometimes when you were in pajamas at night, you know, you'd go out with just a coat over that and have to stand at attention outside in the cold in Tokyo for 2 hours in the wind and rain and cold and snow on the ground, perhaps. Anyway, in Naoetsu, we were glad when the snow finally went. And it was a surprise because we saw all sorts of things under the snow which we'd never dreamt were there. Little huts and memorials in the cemetery, all invisible under 5 and 6 feet of snow, but all suddenly visible after the snow's melted. And the different jobs to do there, we managed to, well, a small thing, bring back some miso paste. Miso, M-I-S-O, is Japanese for crushed soybeans. And soybeans have a little vitamin B in them, so they're good for that. And that, when it's crushed, they make a kind of, it looks like a kind of peanut butter. And we used to like to get some of that in our own hands and put it onto our rice and eat it as something a little extra, more food, miso paste. We got that. That was used in all the soups in all the places I've been, in Korea, in Tokyo, and in Naoetsu. It's a basic Japanese ingredient for making a soup or improving a stew, I suppose, too. Besides soya sauce, which is mostly only sauce, and which is mostly salty liquid, which is all salty liquid, nothing, no particular value in it, I think. But soybeans, we'd had a few soybeans, we'd eaten a few soybeans in Korea, and also a few in Tokyo, occasionally in our rations, put into our rice, which meant that we were used to, this was more nutritious than just pure rice or pure barley, which are not nutritious. We'd also eaten a thing called gaoliang, which grows all over North China and Manchuria and Korea. Gaoliang, which is a sorghum. It grows in America, but not in Europe. And it has a brown seed at the top, a cluster of brown seeds at the top, a brush of brown seeds. And these can be boiled like rice, but they make a very coarse, brown-colored, boiled rice-type meal. And that was our basic rice in Tokyo. Most of the time was sorghum, not rice or barley. In Naoetsu, it was the same thing: sorghum instead of gaoliang sorghum. Instead, gaoliang is the Chinese name for sorghum to eat, and the same kind of awful daikon is a white radish this long, like a church candle, thick,
about 18 inches long
and thick, and like a candle in a church, and cut up it just tastes of radish, of course, and that was put into soup, and there's very little nourishment in it, but that was our basic soup in all three places. Our basic soup was daikon and water for the soup, and a little miso or shoya sauce to give it some flavoring and color, and this gaoliang stuff. That was our food. The daikon, we really got fed up with daikons, gosh. It's so easy to grow, so plentiful in Korea and Japan, and that's what they eat a great deal of. They pickle them too, in Korea particularly. And even in Japanese special food, it's all nicely decorated and so on. They have daikon there, which I would throw out every time I detected it. So there we were. We couldn't help the Australians much except by bringing in some food and trying to cheer them up and so on and so on. And they got better when they got more information and more of us there, the Americans and British and Australians. And we got on better when we all reacted upon each other and spread information and background information and so on amongst each other. And that helped. And I made two very good friends among the Australians whom I saw after the war at ceremonies in Singapore and so on, and in Sydney. And I was really glad to meet them. I was glad to help them too, because I had, being brought up in the Far East, I had a feeling about Australians that they were the neglected colonials far away, you might say, from England. And so I stood up for them. I even sometimes stood up for Don Bradman against England at cricket, which wouldn't pass what's-his-name's test.
Norman Tebbit's test.
But I love to see Don Bradman do 200 and 300 occasionally. I approve 100% of the Australians, and I like them. And I think they've got a great future now. They're going ahead like anything. So that was the Australians, and then towards the end, suddenly we had to unload a lot of coal ships, and Watanabe, angry with us about everything and particularly something, ordered us to go out unloading coal ships, officers with the men as part of the work force, and I went out on that, and we went out to sea. It was a flat coast there, not a harbour. Flat coast, straight coast, and we went out to sea about half a mile, three quarters of a mile, and there were colliers offshore and with coal. We climbed aboard and joining Japanese crew there, we unloaded colliers full of coal from the keel to the top of the hold. And the system was three, they put down nets. With the network, and into that you threw the coal. It was very soft coal, so it was quite easy to dig. But usually it was soft coal. Sometimes it was hard coal, and there you had to dig very hard to get them up, get the coal into it. But you had to dig this coal, throw it into the net, and then the net went up, was drawn up again by the winch. And there was just time to fill your net before it was. A net would come down empty. You'd work on it, and you'd just get it full by the time it had to go up again, and the next net was coming along empty for you to start again. You just went on doing net after net, and five nets for each hold, one left, right, left, you know, north, south, east, west, and center, and then up through the hole, through the hold, onto the deck, over the side, into the little ferries or lighters, and lighters which took the coal ashore. And we started doing that job, and we knew that the bastard was going to make us stick at this job all the time, not let the officer business carry any weight anymore and give us anything semi-labouring, like officers had done most of the time in Japan and Korea. So we started on that, and something else I can say. Oh yes, before that one day, he'd punishing an American officer, chap called Zamperini, who'd been an Olympic athlete, Louis Zamperini, who'd run the 1500 meters for America and came first among the Americans in the Olympic Games at that event. He punished him for he gave him a goat to look after one day, and the goat died. So he said, "Oh, goat die, you die now." So he took Zamperini, stood him up. In the yard where we all were, and gave him a beam of wood 5 feet long and 6 inches by 6 inches by 5 feet, and told him to hold it above his head. and he held it above his head, and he just left him there like that. And he was sat on a roof of a little low building nearby and laughed and joked in the sunshine, even tried to joke with us, joked with the Japanese who all came out to watch this torture going on. And Zamperini held this post above his head like this for about 27 minutes before, I think it was 27 minutes before, we had a clock there, before he collapsed and Watanabe let him go. And it was a terrible thing to see. So that was the kind of punishment he sometimes imposed on people. There was another man who tried to imitate Watanabe and went around beating up people and standing in attention as hard as he could. And we got really fed up with him and thought we'd fix him at the end of the war. But in the end, nobody did. He ran away, as many of them did. They ran away, the sinners, the really cruel bastards. They ran away and hid themselves rather than face us and the Japanese seniors who might come in. That made me think of somebody else. Anyway, we back to the rail, back to the bridge, back to the bridge, not the bridge, back to the ships and unloading the coal. After we'd done this on six ships, I came back one day from the sixth ship with the other officers who'd been doing the same shift, same work party, unloading the same collier. We got back to land, and Watanabe came storming out on the work parade as soon we were in line for in ranks for dismissal. He stormed out and said, "Some prisoners steal special vegetable from Japanese ship. All who did it, come out here now. I want to punish. All must come out now. Any man who stole special vegetable, come out." And one man, two men, three men went out. Four men went out. And I thought, oh God, we're going to be in trouble. This must be more than four. And then after then, seven men went out, or eight. Eight men went out. And I thought, well, that's it. That's enough. That's enough. That could have been eight men did it. In truth and in fact, eight men stolen that vegetable and nobody else. But he said, more men, what? More men. Nobody came. So he walked along and he said, "Wado, go up front." And I went and stood in the front. "Tinker," an American officer, "Tinker, go in front." And Tinker came and stood in front. Then he came back to the center stage and said, "These men steal special vegetable from Japanese ship. You must punish. All must punish. What you do is this. Each man must slap each of these men on the face, once on this side, once on that side of the cheek. This cheek, then that cheek, with arm full length, like that." Like that, and he demonstrated. And then 90 men came and carried out this punishment on behalf of Watanabe on us, 10 men. Eight soldiers, other ranks, and two officers. And they beat us up. And several of the English soldiers said, "Sorry, sir," just before they did it. And some of them tried to make it a quick movement, but slow at the near contact, or make no contact. And he stopped them and made them do it again and again. So 90 men, two blows each is 180, and the extras we had, we got about 220 blows each on each cheek. Tinker and I and these eight soldiers. And that was his prime and his final big effort with me. Not very long after that, of course we went away reeling, extrusion. What are they called? Extrusions. Intrusion. I've forgotten the word. Used to use it a lot in the police. About prisoners.
Never mind.
The grazed and contusions of the skin on both cheeks and that. But no serious bloodshed, just like with the other one with the what do you call it stick in Tokyo camp. No serious bloodshed, so nobody thought much of it. You know, you come out and you say, "Oh, I got beaten up, that's all." No bleeding, no broken eardrums. Oh yes. Watanabe broke six eardrums of other officers and men in the Tokyo camp. Six eardrums he broke. And that one of the officers, so badly, he went deaf, half deaf, within 10 years of getting back to America, within 8 years of getting back to America. And I know him well, and I'm in contact with him still, if he's still alive. since Christmas before last, and he's quite deaf in one ear and damaged in the other from blows from Watanabe. So then, not long after that, the war ended. The war ended in a strange way. We were just told one day that there would be, not sure about this work party tomorrow, somebody said. The work parties went out as normal. No, wait, how did it end? Yes. One day, it was now August 1945, and I'd read a scrap of a Japanese newspaper had been brought to me a few days earlier, and I had read, because I could still read a little Japanese, and in its three scripts, read that an electron bomb had been dropped on Hiroshima and had killed a great many people.
Electron bomb.
I translated this to the men, to the officers, and it spread to everybody in the camp. And that was the news we had of the bomb on Hiroshima. Then, a few days later, we all know exactly how many days later it was, 5 or 6, whoever, anybody can tell you, 6, no, from the 6th to the 15th, 14th.
About a week anyway.
Yes, a little more than a week later, the men went out to work. And as soon as they got to work, they were told, don't bother with that, wait, something else. And then they were told, everybody on parade in the square. There's always a square somewhere to buy a workplace, factory, front of the factory. And they went out on the square, and there was a radio set up center stage. And they all went out there, all the Japanese came out too. Every single Japanese from the factory came out in the same place too. And they all stood there. And then they all bowed, and they heard the throne is going to speak. And so they all bowed, and then a little later they heard a squeaky voice in the distance. And then all the Japanese bowed some more, and they walked away silent. And one or two, in just about starting to tears, and they were in tears a little later, some of the Japanese. And then they wouldn't say anything at first, but then gradually they said, "War over. Emperor has ended the war. War is over. Emperor has ended the war." And so the prisoners were delighted, and they said, "No work." And soon after that, they were marched back to camp. They all came back into camp, saying, "It's over, it's over, it's over." Everybody's shouting and screaming, "It's over, it's over, the goddamn, after all this time, it's finally over," and so on and so on and so on and so on, it's over. And running around the camp and speaking to each other and saying, "No work today, too." And we told it immediately, the senior officers, we gathered together and we sent one of them to the process of working, the officer in charge of the kitchen, to the Japanese in charge of the camp and the kitchen, and said, "We want more food straight away. We want more food from this lunch, from midday today." And the Japanese said, "We got no more. We got to get out what you have." So they went and got out a few of the things that they had, little reserves they had of vegetable of some kind, and a little more extra rice, and gave us that for lunch, that for the midday meal that day, you see. And we had that. And then we said, "We want more. We want meat. We want this. We want meat, particularly," we said. So they went out prospecting, trying to find meat for us. They realized it was the only sane thing to do, because they suddenly realized that we were a little more frightening than we had been when we were speaking more quietly and were more obedient. And we're talking rougher now. And so they got us some meat. They got us five little dogs came in, and those were skinned and went into our soup. So we had five little dogs. And they got some pork one day, and they got some pork another day. And they managed to buy a few more vegetables and threw them in. So the food slightly improved. And then overcame American fighter planes from the fleet. And they identified the camp. Oh, first of all, they had sent message through. We got a message from the American command to all the prison camps. Put up PW on the roofs of the buildings and the number of men in your camp. So we put up PW, big PW, in cardboard and wood. And 720, 730 on the side. And so they identified that, and they threw over chocolate bars as they passed and things like that, and went back to their ships. And then a few days, only 2 days after that, overcame B-29 bombers, beautiful big bombers, flying on the at 5,000 feet, low, so you could see them. And on the wing, on one wing was written, "Food for PWs," painted on large on these wings. You could read it right from the beginning. And they dropped food. They dropped, first of all, into the camp, which only had a small yard, and it broke a roof and broke a man's leg. And we heard in other camps it killed a few people. So we quickly made signs and everything else, said, "Drop in the rice field alongside." So they, after that, they dropped in a big rice field that adjoined this particular camp in Tokyo, in Nowets. It couldn't be done in a city camp.